All right. Welcome, everyone. All five of our first listeners who will be listening to this podcast.
G'day.
Hello, my parents.
Hey, Lou's parents.
Yeah, this is the Ideas Matter podcast, episode one, where we will be discussing books that we've read. Either we've both read them or we'll interview each other about books that we've read. They'll mostly be about, I'd say, philosophy, political theory, history, anything else you'd add to that.
I reckon that just about covers it for the time being. I mean, maybe as we go on, we can add other things, but
yeah.
Stick to that for now.
I think, you know, like theory is where our interests mostly like intersect, but particularly when we're doing books that, you know, we've read, we can interview each other about other stuff as well. But, my name's Louis.
My name's Alex.
And yeah, welcome to the Ideas Matter podcast. Today we're going to be discussing a book that I read about a year ago now, The Ethics of Authenticity by Charles Taylor. It's a pretty short book because it's actually comes from a speech that he gave. I think it was the Massey Lectures in Canada. He gave it, I think, in the 90s or the late 80s. And the original title of the speech was The Malaise of Modernity, which I think is much better than The Ethics of Authenticity.
Yeah, but no, much better.
Yeah, it's much more catchy. I like the alliteration. But Ethics of Authenticity makes sense once you realize what his actual argument is. But before we get into that, just Charles Taylor, he's a Canadian philosopher, still alive, although he's pretty old these days. Went to Oxford, teaching at McGill in Canada. Pretty famous, like, I don't know, had you heard of him before you'd read this book?
I'd heard the name. I can't say I'd looked at him in my philosophy course, but there wasn't really any like political philosophy in the course that I did.
Yeah.
But I feel like if you've kind of looked into philosophy enough, he would have come up at some point. And if you're not familiar with his ideas, then at least you know him by name.
Yeah, 100%. He's particularly someone who comes up if you're interested in like philosophy of religion. Because he's got his latest book is Secular Age, where he talks about secularization, and he is Catholic, which might not sound important, but
wait, is he? I actually didn't know.
Yeah, he's Catholic. Yeah, a lot of these like communitarian philosophers, which I'll explain in a sec what that is, but Patrick Deanan, Alistair MacIntyre, Charles Taylor.
Yeah, I like the Alistair MacIntyre route because he was like an atheist Marxist who philosophized his way into old school 13th century Catholicism.
And, I'm pretty sure this is true, but Alistair MacIntyre's PhD supervisor was Charles Taylor.
Was it?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there's sort of like a communitarian lineage, but a lot of them happen to be Catholic. And a lot of, you know, communitarian critiques of liberalism are very much steeped in, like, Catholicism.
There's always kind of an implicit or, you know, often also explicit critique of Protestantism and the kind of ontology of the self and the self's relation to God in Protestantism, but I feel like we can we'll get a bit deeper into that as we go on into this.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that I wanted to mention because there's a lot of when he talks about individualism and liberalism, you know, a lot of it really historically comes from like the Protestant Reformation. So we'll definitely get into that. But just briefly, so you know what we're talking about, when we say communitarianism, it's really just a political philosophy that like actually arose as a critique of liberalism. So it's not really a full-blown political theory in its own right. It's more of a critique. Because, you know, liberalism emphasizes the individual, right? You think of like people in a state of nature when you read Hobbes, Locke. And they're sort of like alone by themselves. They only enter into society to fulfill some sort of ulterior motive. Whereas communitarians are like, no, that's one, ahistorical, but B, like human nature is necessarily, Taylor uses the word dialogical. You're always in dialogue with someone else. Like you actually need other people. You need a community to have human flourishing. So that's sort of the basis of their critique of liberalism. Obviously, we're going to flesh that out more, but when we say communitarian, you can just think of it as individuals or the community, what's more important in a social sense. And communitarianism would lean, as the name implies, towards the community.
And just as an addendum to that, it's not necessarily completely antithetical to liberalism. I mean, as we'll talk about Charles Taylor and this text, he definitely draws on it quite a bit. He sees a lot that's worthwhile and worth sustaining of the liberal project, but thinks that we need to kind of cut back the socially corrosive excesses of it, and have those kind of liberal individual self-fulfillment ideas within a community setting.
That's a really good point, and that's why I said that it's a critique of liberalism rather than a standalone political theory, because they do concede that like some level of individualism is good, but this is the whole point of the book, is that if you take it too far, it becomes self-defeating. So it's kind of like a scaffold to individualism. It's like, if you really want to realize its benefits, then you need to sort of buttress that with community. So I mean, that's a pretty good intro into the sort of a summary overview of the book, really. I guess how I got into it is, you know, because I've always been an atheist, but if you, you know, atheism is sort of by default materialistic. And so I found after a while it's not very good. Well, materialism is not very good at giving you a moral worldview. There's a huge irony in like the new atheist movement where they're very like strident about their beliefs. You know, they sort of hate cultural relativism, but their moral worldview has to be materialistic because they have no time for any sort of metaphysics.
And it's like there's a big God-shaped hole in their worldview that they just kind of, they will it away without really addressing it. Like what is, they claim to have this kind of like objective, like moral arbiter, but like without a God, like what is that objective moral arbiter?
Exactly. And they don't do any of the philosophical work to sort of get a moral bedrock that you need if you're going to take away religion. Like, what is your moral axiom? Like, you can't just say it's wrong to cause suffering. Why is it wrong to cause suffering? I mean, that might sound like a trivial question to most people, but philosophically, like, you need to ground it somehow. And I think, you know, there's this sort of problem that's arising in, like, Western societies as they become more atheistic, more agnostic, more materialistic. There's this kind of, like, moral vacuum that's arising. And people sort of step into it and give bad answers. But I think the problem that they're addressing is actually quite a good one. Someone like Jordan Peterson, you know, like, gives really terrible answers, in my opinion, to, like, this issue. But he's right in talking about the issue. Like, people have an absence of meaning. People don't know, you know, how to structure their moral life. They sort of they intuitively feel that, you know, pure hedonism is unfulfilling, but that's all society gives them as a moral framework. And so I was thinking about this problem, and it led me towards Charles Taylor, led me towards the ethics of authenticity, because he begins the book by talking about those concerns up front. And he diagnoses the problem by saying that they sort of stem from three interrelated worries. The first is a worry about individualism, or sort of excessive individualism, to be more precise. The primacy of instrumental reason, or what you might call rationalism, this idea that anything that's valuable has to be able to be measured in cost-benefit terms.
Like, valuable for something.
Exactly. I mean, you can think about that today when sort of every social policy is defended in terms of like economics. It's not just a good idea to like help homeless people. You know, how will it boost GDP? Like, you know, that's sort of the thing that he's getting at. And then the third one, which he spends much less time on, but is sort of derivative of the first two concerns, is that people sort of feel today that there's a lack of control over society, over the direction of society, that even though we live in these liberal democracies, we don't really have much political agency. You know, think of people who say there's no point voting, all the major parties are the same, wasting your vote. You know, it's all concerns that I think most people actually feel, but Taylor's trying to sort of articulate them philosophically. Anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, I just add as a bit of context, he is drawing on and kind of responding to a couple texts that were very popular in the kind of political, American political environment of the time in the 80s. One of them is The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom, who I believe is a literary critic and a philosopher. And the other one would be Culture of Narcissism by Christopher Lash. And I can't speak for Closing of the American Mind, but I have read Culture of Narcissism, where Lash pretty much argues that America is essentially narcissistic. America, and you know, you can look at this in other Western societies as well, such as Australia. I think it's very clearly the case here if you look at particularly a lot of millennial and kind of Zoomer youth culture. The lack of any sort of kind of communal identities, communal values, leads people into this inward-looking, self-centered, self-serving, narcissistic standpoint. He argues pretty much that this narcissism is like a cultural side effect of capitalism, liberal individualism, you know, traditional modes of social relation and authority. You know, people are no longer bound to their parents. You're not bound to a family. You're not bound to a community, church, so on. So you kind of get individuals are uprooted and processed by states and corporate bureaucracies, to protect them from the vagaries of a kind of, you know, this Hobbesian war against all, war of all against all. Now, the result of a person that's processed in that way, you know, reduced to this individual unit who's sold cures to their woes, these manufactured problems through advertising, through social work, through therapy, effectively becomes narcissistic, you know, short of a collective-based effort to counter the economic and social conditions that replicate narcissism, we're sort of stuck with it. Now, he was writing about this back in, like, when did this come out? I'm seeing it now. It came out in 1978, and it seems remarkably prescient, looking at this in the light of social media in particular.
Yeah, that's the most fascinating thing about all these sort of critiques is I always read them and I go, wow, this is, if this was true then, what would they say about social media? I mean, it's just really what they're talking about manifest in technology.
Yeah.
It's such a perfect example of, it's such a vindication of their theory. But yeah, bringing in Lash is great because he, a lot of it is a response to Lash and the culture of narcissism. But he Taylor uses the phrase, the culture of self-fulfillment, which I feel is a sort of slightly better way of describing what he's getting at, but what you were talking about, that that people today, people our age, it's this idea that the only moral goal in life is to find self-fulfillment.
Yeah.
You know, it, don't worry about bettering society. Don't worry about acting in service of some higher good. It's this idea that, you know, you have to find yourself.
Yeah.
That morality is, he has some great quotes on this, but it's, you know, morality is sort of recovering authentic moral contact with the voice within yourself.
Yeah. No, 100%. How Lash would kind of characterize this is that, like, the kind of individual unit we have now, the narcissist, fundamentally unable to sustain a true connection with another human being because they're so hamstrung by their like kind of ideation of this like frictionless personal gain disguised as self-care.
And you know, like the Taylor, it kind of reveals the datedness of this text because a lot of the examples he gives are of like women pursuing careers over raising the family, or he like mentions homosexuality a few times, which
that was kind of sus.
Like makes him sound like unnecessarily conservative. But I think you can share these critiques without being conservative because
there's definitely. You can look at these critiques from a very left-wing angle, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he mentions Marx quite a lot. But yeah, I mean, the career one is probably a better example. I mean, it doesn't have to be just about women. It's basically like making money and succeeding in your career is how to live your life. Like that is a mark of success, you know. Like these things that aren't valued by the market.
Yeah.
Having friends, having a family. Doing something creative, doing something that you just get enjoyment out of but can't be measured economically, they don't have any moral weight in our society.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about can you succeed in the market? Can you succeed in your career?
Exactly, yeah. It's the instrumental reason where there's a life that's been completely molded toward instrumental reason. And, you know, what is instrumentally valuable about having connections to your community?
Absolutely. Dude, I reread, because the first time I read this was over a year ago. So yeah. I quickly reread Ethics of Authenticity in the last 2 days. And it was quite, you know, fortuitous, because do you remember there was this controversy recently that there was this op-ed published in the New York Times, and it was about Friends? No. They actually pulled it. Like, a lot of people heard about the article because it got taken down. Like
Friends, the TV show?
No, sorry. Like, Friends.
The concept of having Friends.
The concept of having Friends. So this person wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about why you should have Friends. And I don't know if it was a man or a woman, but they were basically like...
That's really weird. Just
yeah.
The premise of that at all.
The fact that it needs explaining why you need Friends. Yeah. But they were basically like, you know, Friends are utilitarian. Like, Friends are supposed to bet, like... You're supposed to get some sort of utility from them. Like, I don't know, I only hang out with you because we're making this podcast. Yeah. Like that would be a very, like, utilitarian, like, I get some sort of cost benefit.
That is remarkably sociopathic.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And
Jesus.
They go a step further.
How did
and
that
it's
get
like,
published?
Well, that's why I got taken down, because there was such a backlash to it. But they were saying, you know, it's this idea that comes up quite a lot in self-help, that like if you have friends who are struggling, if you have friends who aren't as successful as you are, and success is always a byword for making money, cut them out of your life. Just get rid of them. And it's a perfect example of what Taylor was talking about, that like you have no moral duties to anyone but your own sense of self-fulfillment.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is how that bleeds into the second point, is that how you measure that self-fulfillment is purely through instrumental reason.
Mm-hmm.
How are you succeeding in life? Are you making money?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it is a cultural critique, really.
Yeah. But it's a cultural critique mixed with a material critique as well, because he draws on the development of capitalism a lot in explaining much of this. How, in pursuit of this instrumental reason, people become increasingly individualized due to, you know, having to chase careers, having to chase jobs. And due to this like basic material fact of people having to work all the time, there is no real space for people to value family, to value, not necessarily value, but to spend much time toward those things. And as a result, they atrophy and they kind of, they whittle away.
Yep. Oh, that's a great point. And again, like you're killing it with these segues, because that's like, that's how you get into his third concern, right? Mm. Because I think he's kind of weak on how these things arise, but that's not his job. He's more doing an analysis of the problems of them. But here he talks briefly about, as you said, the development of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have these ideas of individualism, and then they get institutionalized.
Yeah.
And then his point is that once they get institutionalized, and this is his drawing on Weber here, that once they're institutionalized, it's incredibly hard to, I think in his words, live a lifestyle against the grain.
Yeah.
Like he gives the point of the way cities are designed. You need to own a car.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have massive philosophical objections to, I don't know, environmental degradation, you want to ride a bike, just the way that society is developed sort of forces you to live in a certain way. And you can think of other examples as well. Like I think social media is another good one. You know, if you don't have social media, people think you're a bit of a weirdo.
Yeah.
Or people kind of think there's something wrong with you.
Mm.
Maybe you've got something to hide. I don't know, but it's or it makes life hard
because
everything is sort of premised around you conforming to the way that society is structured.
Yeah, you can find that particularly with young men in the West. There's this real strong sense of impotence. People no longer able to see themselves sort of reflected in the world around them, or at least the things they value aren't reflected in the world around them, and at least this really poisonous reaction to it, you know, particularly like young men, young male anger against the world, against women, against minorities. And it seems like a way for them to reflexively, you know, reclaim some sort of communal identity on the basis of being a man or
being white.
Being white. But it's... you're not really fulfilling that communitarian, that real communitarian drive that Taylor will talk about a little later on, because it's, you're going from a reactionary basis that's necessarily corrosive to communal ties if you're that poisonous and exclusionary. You know, it's completely corrosive.
100%. I mean, he doesn't really talk about this in the book, but I think if he were to write it again today, if you were to ask him, he would totally agree that, like, the rise of right-wing populism, sort of the alt-right, sort of this resurgence of, not even a resurgence, I'm sure it's always been there, but it's much more aggressive now.
Yeah.
Like, misogyny and racism amongst, you know, some, like, white men, particularly in the United States.
Mm.
He would say, yeah, I mean, this is a reaction to the fact that, like, these people do not know what to do with their life.
Yeah.
They have no, what he would say, moral horizon.
Yeah.
They don't know how to structure their life. Mm-hmm. What do they orient their life towards?
Yeah.
What is the purpose of life? And this is really what drove me towards these kind of communitarian critiques. Because if you listen to explanations on the quote-unquote left, you know, they're not really lefties, sort of progressives, will just say, well, you know, these people are just pathetic, racist, mm-hmm. sexists, and then they can't really explain why that this stuff arises.
Yeah, they don't have a how they got there, and they don't have a where do we go from here.
Yeah, there's no.
They just have a look at them as they are right now, like, oh, that's shit, and like, yeah, it is shit, but like, that's not helpful. Anybody can have a look at someone being incredibly,
yeah.
Turning towards like racist and sexist politics and be like, yeah, that's shit. Of course, it's straightforwardly fucking awful, but what you do with that, how you proceed from there is the important thing, I feel.
Yeah, where did it come from,
yeah.
Right? And if you're a communitarian, it's pretty easy to say where, like, everyone needs a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs, you know, not everyone is it's, there's a lot of elitism going around, I feel, where it's this kind of like, yeah, make your own values.
Yeah.
You can, you know, decide how you want to live your own life. I mean, making your own values, I mean, that's pretty hard.
Yeah.
Right? It's I think it's just like tertiary educated, like gatekeeping progressives who, you know, skim read Nietzsche in their second year and they're like, yeah, everyone can, you know, make up their own morality.
Yeah.
It's like, well, no, they can't.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot
and
of...
And second thing, you haven't.
Yeah, you haven't either. I mean, Taylor, like, calls that out directly. Mm. He was like, these people are selfish.
Mm.
They go and do their undergraduate degree. And I think in his words, that it gives their view a patina of philosophical legitimacy. But really, like, it's just self-fulfilling nonsense. Yeah. Like, again, it's like this idea that... There's another great quote, like, moral revelation is found in self-expression,
mm-hmm.
or something to that effect. And you see this on social media, people posting photos of themselves crying.
Yeah, fuck.
Or the glorification of mental illness.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad that we're talking about mental illness more, but it so often just goes towards, like, that is my personality.
Mm.
You know, like, who I am is morally valid.
Mm.
I mean, it's valid, but... It's not moral.
Yeah, for sure. It's building your personality around these just absolute emotional reflexivity.
Like, that's a good way of putting it.
It's building a worldview around emotional response,
yep.
You know, your private emotional response toward things rather than any sort of greater sense of community or idealism or anything like that.
100%. Yeah, because, and this is another part of it, right? It's that if the self is the only morally valid unit,
mm-hmm.
and expression is how you reveal that the sort of innate moral truth that's in everyone, like, who am I?
Yeah.
What is my unique way of being?
I need to find myself.
Yeah, I need to find myself, right? Then this sort of moral weight gets given to people's immediate emotional reactions to things. Yeah. There's no discussion of, I think he says this about desire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, liberalism says people should be free to choose their desires.
Yeah.
I think most people can agree to that to an extent. But what's missing is, what is a good desire?
Yeah.
What is it good to want?
Mm-hmm.
That's completely absent by design,
mm-hmm.
from liberalism. You know, and sure, the way people feel is important, but how should you feel?
Yeah.
You know, your emotional reaction to something is not a moral insight. Mm-hmm. So we've covered Taylor's critique quite a fair bit, and I think it's probably good at this point to actually say, well, what is the positive part of this book? And
mm-hmm.
this is where you sort of understand why he's titled it the way he has, The Ethics of Authenticity, because he says that all this individualism, all this selfishness, all this narcissism that we've been talking about, it's a trivialized, bastardized form of an underlying ideal that he thinks is actually valid.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of self-fulfillment actually has moral weight, but it's just been taken too far. It's just been trivialized. And this is the communitarian critique.
Yeah.
And he sort of, you know, he exposes it to what Marx would call imminent criticism. And imminent criticism is just when you use something's own logic against it to see if it holds up.
Yeah, for sure.
And so that's what he does to liberal individualism. He goes, okay, I agree with you that we should, you know, individuals should be able to pursue what they want. They should be able to flourish. But to be able to do that, we actually need other people. And we actually need a sort of social background that's significant. But we can't decide what is significant. Mm. The community does that.
Yeah.
So individuals in a vacuum actually can't flourish and live a moral life because it requires some sort of social context that they didn't choose.
Yeah. And I think you can see this reflected in popular culture a lot today, particularly with the NPC meme that's become pretty big recently. Like this idea that everybody thinks they're exercising their own individuality, but through doing so, they're parroting the same things and the same same desires as everybody else around them.
I mean, he says that explicitly in the book. He's like, you know, ironically, a lot of these people who are pursuing self-fulfillment and being unique and original actually end up looking very similar.
Exactly, because it's like people see self-fulfillment as the fulfillment of their own desires, but what conditions those desires? From where do those desires come?
Yeah.
And
society.
As a good Hegelian, Charles Taylor has the view that these desires are, as you said, socially conditioned.
Mm.
What you think you want to do, what you think is good for your life, comes from the world around you. And in this kind of individualist, you know, instrumentally reasoned society, people are going to want to desire the same things. And in pursuing their own individualism, they end up looking and sounding and feeling exactly the same as everyone else.
Yeah, so it sort of undercuts itself.
Mm.
And that's his criticism of it, right? Because he wants to defend it. He actually is, like you mentioned Lash at the start, he thinks Lash goes too far.
Mm.
He thinks Lash would you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater
in
terms of this culture of self-fulfillment.
Mm.
He agrees that it's gone too far, but there is actually an ideal that underpins it.
Yeah.
It's, I guess, how would you express it in more favorable terms? That people, that the difference between people has a moral salience, right? That everyone has like a voice within themselves that they should try and sort of recover contact with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, saying recover is very Protestant or very, but that's where it comes from, right? It comes from Protestantism, that everyone has a direct line to God. But then as that gets secularized, you sort of cut out God. And everyone has a direct line to themselves.
Yeah.
And then that's, you know, expressing that is moral. You know, and so he says this ideal on the whole is good. It just needs to be sort of constrained with like duties to others, duties to the community, duties to the planet, which I think is important. And he mentions that quite a lot. You need to constrain this self-fulfillment, which in the end will actually make it better. But I don't know. Do you agree with him there? Like, is the ideal of self-fulfillment, if properly constrained, morally good?
Yeah, I think there is something valuable there because I forget if it's in Taylor or if it's in Lash or Alistair MacIntyre, but one of these communitarian sort of thinkers made the point in one of their books that once you let individualism out the bag, you can't really get it back in.
Yeah.
Like, how do you kind of build an individual society back towards sort of like pure collectivity? So I think it's valuable in the sense that it gives a communally based, like a communally oriented sense of individual expression, you know, this ability to kind of find yourself, but it's finding yourself within a community. And I think so long as you keep it within those bounds, it is valuable and something that we ought to kind of aspire for in society.
Yeah, I mean, I broadly agree with that. And you don't want to obviously totally get rid of individualism because it has good political side effects and sort of individual rights. Like, I'm not going to go on the record saying I don't believe in individual rights. Obviously, I do.
I want to clip that and send it to the Herald Sun or something.
Yeah, that's going to be the soundbite for this podcast. I don't believe in civil liberties. No, but I don't know. I would just express my distaste for self-fulfillment probably more stridently than you would, because I really don't like this culture of whatever I feel is valid, whatever I desire is valid, as long as it's not, you know, it's the liberalism of neutrality.
Yeah.
Anything that you want to do, as long as it doesn't directly harm others, is morally okay.
Yeah. And no, I agree with you on that.
Yeah. I really have to push back on that, because number one, I think people overestimate how isolated they are. Mm. They think that they're just an island, right? And I have quite, I don't know what the word is, conservative views on this, but people aren't isolated from others, and actually everything you do affects other people, even if you're not just directly harming them. I remember watching Q&A once, and someone said, you don't owe other people your health, and I vehemently disagree with that. I think you do owe other people your health, because your health affects how you interact with other people.
Yeah, I think this is something that McIntyre does a lot better than Charles Taylor, because he would completely agree with you on that. McIntyre is coming from this Aristotle, like virtue ethics view of community, where he claims that people ought to have communally oriented lives again. But the way to act right, you know, the way to exercise moral behavior in a communal society is through cultivation of virtues. You know, building characteristics within yourself in how you interact with other people, and through building those good traits, building those good characteristics, moral behavior will flow back into the community. So doing good is not just doing good to others, it's doing good to yourself.
Yes.
You know, it's all kind of all links in the same chain.
That's a perfect expression of what I was trying to get at, right? It's not just about like, am I a good friend to, or a good boyfriend to other people when I'm interacting with them directly?
Yeah.
But my ability to fulfill those relationships actually derives from how I treat myself.
Mm.
You know, do I respect myself? Do I eat well? Mm. Do I exercise? Do I, you know, address mental health considerations?
Yeah.
If I just threw my hands up and said, no, whatever my immediate desires, I'm just going to immediately fulfill them. Well, that does impact other people, right? If I just started eating McDonald's every day and I had a sugar crash every time I came home and I was irritable and horrible to be around, like, people today would say, oh, yeah, well, I mean, that's bad.
No, like, I agree with what you said there. There's, you know, that strong sense that you can kind of do whatever the fuck you want as long as you're not hurting anyone. But, no, there definitely are moral ideals you ought to uphold just in your behavior towards yourself and behavior to others. And, you know, people have this, as I said, people have this strong sense that you can't really morally blame anyone for doing things like that. And, you know, the point of a moral ideal isn't that you have to be fulfilling it all the time or you're an absolutely bad person. Like, people are flawed, you know. Of course, we can't be reaching that all the time. But it is something we ought to always be striving towards. And drawing on that as well, I think another thing that McIntyre does a bit more thoroughly than Taylor, you know, you can't criticize Taylor too hard on this. It's only like a 100-page book compared to McIntyre. I think it's like 350 pages or something. Where McIntyre goes into how we conceive the self. You know, he rejects this idea of the liberal individualist self, you know, you are some completely atomized thing that exists. There is a core, there is someone like who you are that exists completely independently of any ties to others. Where McIntyre would say, no, it's a lot more porous than that. You are your selfhood is constituted by your ties to others. And that's where his idea of virtues come in, where doing good, you know, cultivating these virtues and doing good to yourself and others are one and the same thing. If you act well towards your community, towards the connections you have in your life, you are acting morally towards yourself. And if you're acting morally towards yourself, you know, you're cultivating good character, you're taking care of yourself and so on, you are acting in a morally upright way toward your external ties, your community, your friends, your family, what have you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the point about striving and never achieving is a good point, or never always achieving.
Yeah.
Right. And this goes back to Plato.
Yeah.
Right. That a human being is always becoming, never being.
Yeah.
Right. You're always in a state of trying to reach what Taylor would say the moral horizon.
Mm-hmm.
By definition, you don't reach a horizon. It's always in the horizon.
Yeah.
But that's the point, is that you are constantly struggling.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he says quite explicitly in the book, he quotes someone who says, you know, the struggle is forever. And again, like liberalism, John Mearsheimer, who's an international relations theorist, like puts this very, very well. He says that liberalism basically says you can't have final answers on deep moral philosophical questions. So liberalism's response to that is to just sort of take them off the agenda and to put the onus on the individual. You can come up with whatever answer to that you want, but don't push it on other people. That's liberalism's solution. And that's why it's sort of soft relativism. So it sort of tries to depoliticize it almost.
Yeah.
But Taylor would say, no, like, these things are inherently political. They're inherently debatable. You want to debate them in a communal setting. I mean, that is politics.
Yeah, exactly.
But when you take that away, as is what has happened in modern liberal democracies, all you're left with is sort of dry technocratic concerns. And he addresses that quite explicitly in the book, and it's something that Alexis de Tocqueville foreshadowed. He called it a form of soft despotism, and it really just sounded to me like a foreshadowing of technocracy, where politics is completely sterile. I mean, you see this today in Australia. Like, what is our political debate? It's got nothing to do with what sort of country do we want to be? How should we treat people? How should we treat asylum seekers? It's all about who is the better manager of the economy. I mean, that is really a technocratic question. I mean, I'm sure it has an answer, but it's not really political in the original sense of the word.
Yeah, it's a politics of bureaucracy, essentially.
Yeah.
As you said, we've just kind of lost any sense of striving toward a moral horizon communally. And I feel like people who say this, they can get tarred by the brush of being like, oh, you're a conservative, especially with people on the left or like kind of like center-left leaning. There's this reflexive defense of this anything goes individualism. But it's like, if you want a more free and fair society, then you have to grapple with this.
Yeah.
There's no real way around it. You know, I think Taylor makes the point pretty convincingly that you cannot reach these kind of equitable aims of a left politics. You know, he doesn't make that point clearly. It's kind of a...
Well, he is a lefty, though. Like, we should... Like, I think he actually ran for Canadian Parliament.
Did he?
As a candidate for the New Democratic Party.
Oh, there you go.
Which is sort of, for Australian listeners, probably a little bit more to the left of the Australian Labor Party.
Ah, damn, I was just talking out my ass then. But, yeah, no, there's... You have to grapple with these communal questions, and you have to, if you want to achieve those kind of ends to your society, if you want to make things more equitable for workers, if you want to, you know, make it so there's less income inequality.
Yeah, I mean, to fix any of those problems that you're talking about, you need to actually decide, well, what sort of society do we want?
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And it really depends on having kind of a communal ethical society, you know, a sense of ethics that is communally, that is socially grounded. You know, you can, I'm not too sure how effectively you can sort of achieve those kind of, you know, left-wing equitable moral ends with a collection of individuals that constituting your moral society rather than something that's a bit more you know, communally grounded.
Yeah, I mean, sort of inequality is a sort of natural outcome if individuals are your only moral concern, because it does give an individual the theoretical possibility of achieving incredible levels of material comfort.
Mm.
And if all you care about is the individual, then sure, a society where that's possible is maybe a good one.
Yeah.
But if you care about other people and you recognize constraints and limits upon your own desires, maybe your desire is to become really rich. But if you care about other people, then there's going to be limits to that.
Yeah. You can see this with migrants from sort of non-Protestant societies or non-Western societies, where they still have those deeper communal ties. You know, that it's been fairly well evaporated in a lot of especially Anglo-Western nations. But, you know, like Rudy was saying earlier, you see people from India still have these very deep communal ties. Or, you know, in my own case, people from the former Eastern Bloc, these deeper communal ties still very much exist. So you see people who tend to be a bit more left-wing economically, because they see these economic ends are necessary to achieve, to maintain these sort of communal ethical frameworks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense that you would basically pack up your life and travel overseas and know that you're going to live a life of precarity and you're going to be poor in this new society and experience racism as you try and, you know, as you try and find your footing. It seems weird that you would do all of that only to say, well, you know, if my son or daughter doesn't succeed on the labour market, then they don't deserve healthcare.
Yeah.
I mean, that just sort of seems antithetical
to
the entire immigrant experience. Like, bonds of solidarity are more important in that context. But you mentioned Protestantism, and I said at the start, like, it's important that, that Taylor is a Catholic, because historically, this is not the case anymore, but historically, the early labour movements and the early, like, left-wing social democratic parties in the West were predominantly Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was certainly the case in America. The Democratic Party was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
The Australian Labor Party was Catholic. Because they don't have as strong of an individualistic outlook as Protestants do.
Yeah, for sure. You can definitely see this when you start looking into, like, Calvinism is a real good example of this sort of individual instrumental reason cultural strain, particularly in America, where in Calvinism it's a branch of Protestant theology that says, if God is all-knowing and if God is all-powerful, then he already knows who is going to achieve salvation, you know, who's going to go to heaven and who won't. So that's already determined. It doesn't really matter all too much in your actions whether or not you go to heaven, because he's already got that figured out. But one way you could show it, you know, I'm not too sure really like of the theological argument of how he justifies this next part. One way you can show God's favor is if you manage to get rich. Because if you get rich, then that means God is smiling down upon you.
Yeah.
And you have a better chance of knowing that you're going to go to heaven.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the sort of interconnection between Protestantism, liberalism, and capitalism is all sort of becoming a lot clearer now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a full-blown, like, idealist in the sense that I think that ideas cause outcomes in the world.
Yeah.
But you can't ignore them.
Yeah.
They're certainly very, very important.
No, for sure. And I think where the kind of the sort of like more communal left-wing strain of Catholicism comes in is that it is definitely more communally oriented. Like you were saying earlier, Protestantism has this idea that you have a direct relationship with God. But in Catholic, that's a break from the Catholic view that your relationship with God is mediated through the body of the church, through this communal organization of one, the church hierarchy, which is part of why the split happens. You know, there's deeper political and historical reasons for that. But in a more sort of philosophical sense, kind of contact with God is achieved communally.
Yep.
Even with hermits, you have these Catholic ascetic monks that you might have seen in like the Middle Ages or something. They are still doing this with a sort of philosophical connection to the church body, to this community of the church. That goes part of the way in explaining why those kind of Catholic left-wing movements crossed over quite a bit. And as well, you know, there is a definite material economic part to it where Catholic migrants from Europe came a bit later with a bit less money because they're from poorer areas. So they did kind of constitute an underclass. But yeah, I'd be interested to look at how Protestant left-wing movements or Protestant labor movements operated around the world. Like, I'm sure they were a thing.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what the relationship was between the kind of like philosophical ideas of Protestantism versus kind of material conditions. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, we're almost coming up for time, but all this this might sound, you know, unnecessarily theological, but not really, because Descartes was really the first philosopher to sort of secularize these Protestant ideas of the self and the radical individual by sort of engaging in radical doubt and what he thought was completely abstract, isolated reasoning can derive that, you know, he exists, or, you know, I think, therefore I am, I exist. You humans are just these disengaged minds that exist by themselves in a vacuum, distinct from everything around them. I mean, Descartes said that and he thought he was being super original. But obviously, you know, it's sort of drawing on Protestant ideas. And then you get into Hegel, who would say to Descartes, well, you think you're doing this all by yourself, but the education that you got to be able to do that was communal.
Yeah.
You're actually implicitly drawing upon Protestant ideas. So Hegel really like comes up first with the communitarian critique, and then he passes that along to Marx. This is a very rushed version of intellectual history. He passes that along to Marx, and then Marx obviously has his own critiques of liberalism. But then gradually you get to, you know, communitarianism today. So that's a sort of really rushed philosophical history, but I think that's why it sort of shows why the religious component is important, because it's not the case that Western philosophy is this totally objective, reasonable thing that just fell out of the genius of the human mind.
Yeah.
It's actually very deeply influenced by religious debates, which were the same as philosophical debates for millennia.
Yeah, for sure. Like, there's this kind of sense that when you're doing philosophy, you're doing something very rational and secular.
Yeah.
And you see this particularly when people then talk about thought from, you know, like China or India, and they're like, that's mystical spiritualism.
Yeah.
But then you look at like Descartes or Hobbes, who kind of thought of as providing the basis for these secular liberal worldviews. And there'll be a bit that's like, okay, here's how the self is atomized and so on and so forth. And they moved on and they're like, this is why God is real. And this is how we build a state that orients itself towards fulfilling God's plan on earth.
Well, absolutely. And even Locke, like, explicitly is like, well, humans should, you know, become masters of nature because that's what God wanted us to do.
Yeah.
And that's one of the fundamental axioms of liberalism, or that you should, you know, treat people as if they have natural rights, because of course they have natural rights. Mm. God made them in his image.
Yeah. Like, there's, as I kind of mentioned earlier, there's a big God-shaped hole in a lot of these later liberal ideas that have kind of dropped the religion from it, but by doing so they've kind of lost their like ontological basis for their claims.
Big word.
What is ontology?
Ontology is what exists.
Yeah.
So if you're talking about moral ontology, that's like what is your focus of moral concern.
Yeah.
So an individualist, like the individual, is what exists morally. They mm-hmm. don't recognize moral claims on the community.
Yeah.
Right. Communitarian, by definition, does.
Mm-hmm.
So community is part of their moral ontology.
Yeah, for sure. And I keep on wanting to bring up Alistair MacIntyre. We should really do an episode on
him. We should do an episode on him. And yeah, I mean, my laptop is on 3% charge, so...
Yeah, we'll leave it here then. Yeah. Thank you for listening in, everyone.
Yeah. We might do an episode on Alistair MacIntyre pretty soon. Mm. I'm planning on reading Descartes because I want to dig more into where all this stuff comes from.
We'll do a Descartes episode. That'll be fun.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we'll do an episode on him because he seems to be where the problem arises.
Mm.
But yeah, thanks for listening. Any feedback... There will be an email in the podcast description box, so feel free to send through any feedback.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks.